Hello and welcome to Conquest Corner. I am live at Mello 2018 and today I'm having my second interview and this time I'm with Damien Cannon, who is a, what's the word I'm going to use? I mean, he's a whiz at writing research notes on Stockopedia and also puts them on ShareSog's website as well. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. It's very kind of you to say that.
So, Damien, I'm going to start with the conversation we've had in the past. I'm going to start with you telling me your journey from child to now as to transitioning from education to work, and then we'll get into the investing side of things.
Okay. I mean, something that when I was a kid, you know, I was an only child, so I spent a lot of time by myself, walking the dog, reading things, reading books, and I kind of got into astronomy when I was kind of an early teenager. And I was, you know, I was good at maths, I was good at the sciences, and I was okay at school. And so I kind of decided that what I wanted to do in life was do astrophysics and do research, you know, maybe go to university, and I'd kind of use my brain for, you know, discovering things about the universe, because I was more interested somehow in what was out there in the universe than I was that was here on Earth. And so, you know, I worked my way up to university. I did an astrophysics degree at university, which was good fun. And I thought, I enjoyed that. So I stayed on some research in astrophysics. And I was got a PhD. I was working on various X-ray telescopes. And I really enjoyed it.
Excellent.
However, I realized when I was doing the research that actually I didn't want to stay in academia. Because the problem I found was that it's quite a political place. You know, there's quite a lot at stake, but it's not worth a lot. You know, 'cause it's not a big money thing, but it's all about prestige and who you know. And actually, I discovered I didn't like politics and all that kind of backbiting and all the jockeying for position. Exactly. And so I thought, well, okay, I've tried that and it was great, but I'm gonna leave. So 20 years ago, more or less, I exited academia and wound up getting a job in software development. It's not something I'd ever trained for, but a friend of mine was doing it, and he, you know, I was quite technical. And so he said, why not come and work where I work? And I thought, yeah, okay, that sounds like a plan. So he said, fine, send in your CV. And I sent it in, and they sent me a very nice letter back saying thanks, but no thanks. We're not interested. And he was like, he looked at the letter, and he was like, yeah, these people are idiots. You know, I'm going to go and speak to them.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah. So you know, he went in the next day and talked to them and said, look, you know, this guy's got a PhD, and he's very smart, and you should employ him. And they wrote back and said, okay, can you come in for an interview?
Brilliant.
And obviously, then they gave me a job and everything was fine.
The rest is history. Brilliant.
Yeah. Yes. And that took me up to, 20 years ago. And that's when I first, that was back in 97. And that was when I first got a real job, I suppose, and started earning a bit of real money. And up until that point, you know, being a student, I'd never had any. So I'd never had to think about investing or shares or anything because it simply wasn't practical. But I got a bit of money and I was, you know, young and single, so that was all fine. And fortunately, very fortunately, I stumbled across a book by The Motley Fool. Right. And that was all about, it's about investing, but also about managing your finances, kind of looking after the money you've made. And the thing I liked about that book was that the essential message was that you can do it yourself. You don't need to hire, you don't need to pay investment companies to look after your money or, you know, maybe to look after pensions. You can do it yourself. It's not difficult. And of course, that was at the forefront, I suppose, of the internet and information being more widely available. So I read that and I thought, okay. And another one of their messages was that if you are going to put into a fund, you should do it in a tracker, because all of the managed funds charge you high fees. You know, perhaps slightly higher than they are now, but they're high fees, and you know, their returns are somewhat variable. Put in a tracker. At least you'll follow the index, and they won't charge a lot of money to do it. So I started putting a little bit of money into a FTSE, I think FTSE 100 tracker and a FTSE All Share tracker back then, and that was all I was doing.
And was that on like a monthly sort of averaging, compounding that?
Exactly, which is a fine strategy.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because you don't care whether the market goes up or down. You simply keep putting the money in, and it keeps accumulating.
Okay.
And that was probably good for a good 2 or 3 years, really. And that kind of meant the only downside with that was that I kind of missed out on the dot-com boom, really. Or I mostly missed out on it.
Yeah. So did you do any wider research on the markets to think there's actually selective stocks I could do? You just took the conservative approach initially.
But very much so.
Safety-wise.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, you know,
precious money, having been a student as well.
Well, exactly. I mean, I didn't really want to waste it and I didn't know anything. I mean, I don't know much more now, but I certainly didn't know anything then.
You do.
So, yeah, I thought that was the simplest strategy to get going. And, you know, I read about the internet boom and dot-com boom and being in tech, you know, obviously I could see it happening, but I didn't get involved with it, at least, as you know, at least until the very last moment when lastminute.com came along with a big hoo-ha back in 2000 and it was like, and I was like, oh, this is my chance to make it big.
Yeah. You know, fanfare marketing, wasn't it?
Yes.
This particular IP.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It was fantastic. And I thought, yeah, I can, you know, I can do this kind of internet.com stuff. Mm. So I applied for some large allocation of shares with lastminute.com. And somewhat fortunately, the country is full of people as stupid as I was. And they were all trying to put in for large allocations of shares.
It was scaled right down.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Mm. So I don't know. I probably put in for what, for me, it was a lot of money. I probably put in for £1,000. Mm, mm. And then I ended up getting, I think, £100 or something, maybe £120. So, you know, a negligible sum. But that was fortuitous.
Yes.
Because, you know, as we all know, just a few years later, they were worth a fraction of that, really. And it was only by good chance that they were bought out by someone.
Absolutely, yeah. I think they were friends of friends.
Yes.
When they actually went.
Exactly.
Okay. So was lastminute the first stock that you purchased independently?
Yes.
Regarding your research?
Yes.
And other than the fanfare and the PR marketing regarding that IPO, did you actually research the IPO listing document to say, I'm purchasing it? Or was it just a case of... Jazz hands got you.
Pretty much, yes.
Yeah. Okie dokie.
I would say there was zero research involved at that moment.
So let's go beyond that then and think, there's no strategy then, yes. Right? And now you're writing what you're writing and everyone's like, Damien's written another piece, now you need to have a look at that.
Yeah.
How have you refined that from, let's say, 19 years ago to where you are now, your thesis for research?
Well, yeah, it's been a long journey. That's for sure, with lots of twists and turns. So as I was saying, I read this guide from The Motley Fool, and so I joined The Motley Fool and was reading the message boards. There was Paul E. Pilot's Pub, and there was the Value Shares board, and there was the High Yield board. Mm. And I spent probably a good couple of years just reading the messages and reading what people were doing. I don't think it necessarily gave me a strategy, but I could see that people were investing in shares and there were different ways to do it. And, you know, there was action and, I read people's analyses of shares, really, and tried to kind of get a grip on what was going on. And I was quite taken by, I suppose, two different approaches, really. One of them was something called the high-yield portfolio approach. And that is essentially that says is that you can't really predict the future. I mean, it's kind of uncertain what's going to happen with companies, but if you select specific groups of companies over the long term, they should do okay. They may not do fantastically, but they probably won't do really badly either. And the idea of that is you're looking at companies that have paid a good yield for, 10 years, 15 years. They're quite solid companies. So you're looking at kind of blue chips, really. They haven't got too much debt. You know, you try and diversify by sector. So that's a portfolio approach. Mm-hmm. And that kind of attracted me because I'm a fairly risk-averse kind of person, I think. Mm-hmm. And so something that had some reasonable kind of backing behind it, you know, intellectually speaking,
yeah.
And was also designed to be somewhat safe, attracted me. So I put in, the money. I took some money out of the trackers and put some money into that and started building up a high yield portfolio.
Yeah.
And also that's quite nice because you get dividends and that's quite a pleasing feeling.
Compounding all the time. Yeah.
Exactly. You get the dividend, you put it into another share. It's a very, it's great. I mean, that's a good way to invest.
Yeah.
But obviously at the same time, I was also taken by all this awesome returns that people were making on the Paul E. Pilot's Pub with this share and that share, and they were doing cash shells and stuff like that. And I was like, oh, that sounds awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so...
You're being teased.
Well.
Come over here.
Yes, exactly. It's like, yeah, you could do this. And of course, I couldn't do it. But what I could do was I could copy some of the ideas. I could buy some shares that I thought were cheap and were going to do well.
Mm.
But again, it wasn't a... There was some analysis in that. There's some reading around, but not deep analysis.
Mm.
And I think part of the problem was that there wasn't really the tools, or what tools there were quite simple. I mean, you you didn't have Stockopedia, you didn't have SharePad, really, so you couldn't instantly get a feel for how a company was performing and had performed over a number of years. You know, you could screen for them perhaps, and you could go and look at their reports, but it wasn't simple. And you couldn't kind of do that on a lot of companies, really.
Yeah.
So
it's laborious, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. You know? And so, you know, the companies I invested in were found by chance, really, at that time.
Mm.
And I probably did that probably a couple of years, you know, 03, 04, that kind of 05, that kind of period. And the results were mixed, shall we say.
Okay. So during that period then, if you can think back to the stocks that you purchased.
Yes.
High yield, low risk averse. Mm. Which were the more successful ones? Were they the ones that you'd researched the most, or was it just a case of by chance you picked the dividend plays, the tobacco ones that were doing really well, or whatever?
I think,
what were the winners and what were the losers?
Well, I think that's exactly right. With the high yield ones, there was an expectation that some would be doing better at different times and some
cyclical.
Would be doing worse.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think at the time, some of the banking shares were doing quite well and some of the tobacco shares were doing well. Perhaps the housing ones weren't doing so well. So, there was a mixture. But that wasn't really due to my own research or inabilities. That was just the nature of the portfolio.
Yeah.
With the smaller companies that I'd kind of bought into, which are more kind of micro-cap ones, I think there was kind of luck involved there, really, about whether they're going to do well. Because, you know, I might have bought it just because someone else had mentioned it or it seemed like a good idea, but I hadn't really researched it myself. And so then it might have done well, and that was great. And occasionally, people come up with ideas about takeovers, and it's kind of like, okay, that actually pay out, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't that I'd found it. It was just that I'd been, you know, reading the message boards.
Mm-hmm.
So I think my ability to analyze at that point was very limited.
Mm-hmm.
Not just because, I mean, obviously I was working at the same time, so it wasn't my main focus of attention.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a tension there between a high portfolio isn't designed to be particularly analyzed.
Yes.
Really, you're selecting a portfolio of characteristics, and then you're not going into the company and saying, "Can I understand them in depth?" Because that's not that's not the deal. And the smaller companies, I hadn't really learned how to analyze in depth.
Okay. So now you analyze them in depth, the small caps companies.
And indeed,
you're looking for the red flags to not invest.
Yep.
And you've made some significant investments, and you've done extremely well to the point where people are going, "You need to read that guy's stuff. You need to listen to what he's got to say." So what's happened? What was the trigger and when for you to go, I need to start doing some significant research now?
I mean, I think the obvious trigger was that, you know, I had some fairly heavily losing shares, which and I realised then, obviously, okay, I don't actually know, you know, why. I didn't have a good understanding of that company.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact it went down, I didn't know that at the time, I probably should have had a stop loss and I should have got out. You know, I was still in the kind of mindset that the investor, you know, stays in for the long term. You know, because companies in the long term will do well. And so I didn't feel that I was a trader. So therefore, if I was going to hold a company, I kind of need to hold it through thick and thin, which actually I don't really agree with anymore. But that was my kind of mentality. So I looked around and I thought, well, how can I really learn about investing and about research? And I found this company called Fat Profits.
Yeah.
And they occupy quite an interesting niche in the world because they're not a fund manager. They don't manage people's money. But they're not exactly a tipster service either.
Mm.
And they're not just a research platform. What they do is they say, well, we can help you construct a portfolio of shares. So every week they would come out with research on four or five different companies. And they were essentially running a portfolio of these shares themselves. And they're saying, we're going to research these companies in depth and keep researching them as the facts change. And you can kind of share in the trying to understand the research we're doing. So they would explain why they selected a particular company, whether it was, let's say, it was BAE, perhaps, or they selected, might have selected Lloyds Bank or something.
Mm.
But they wouldn't just say, yeah, you should buy this because it's a really great stock.
Yeah, yeah.
You would get several pages of research on why they thought this was the right time to buy it and why it was a good thing to invest.
Mm.
And that was great because they talked about, you know, they would talk about the earnings quality and they were talking about capital, they were talking about the margins. And they also talk about the macroeconomic pressures on these companies and how they're affecting it. And I actually still have a subscription to this day, actually, to these people, because the quality of their research was fantastic.
Yeah.
And obviously, because it wasn't just a hobby, it was a business, they made sure that they knew what they're talking about. And the nice thing was that when they talked about a company and said, yeah, actually, this is a good time to buy, they would then, it would be in the portfolio, it wouldn't be like 6 months later they've forgotten about it, or if it went down they forget about it.
Mm.
Every time things happened, you know, news, not, they wouldn't be talking about the same companies every week, but when results came out or there was a trading update, they would analyse it again and talk about their reactions to it and whether it's now maybe a sale or not.
Mm-hmm.
And their turnover of stocks was very low, you know, so they would stick with shares if they, you know, if they, the thesis was kind of holding true for the long term, which impressed me.
So with that then, did you and continue to use that as primary now or secondary sort of level of research?
Now that's secondary.
Secondary, yes. So to your own research.
Yes, exactly.
And your own filtering system. So that actually adds a great foundation to whatever that you're looking at.
Yes, exactly. So where we share companies, I quite like to look at what they're saying about it, because it's always kind of interesting to get a different viewpoint. Mm. And this is a viewpoint that's entirely independent from bulletin boards and Twitter and anywhere. It's their own bespoke research. Yeah. But that's not my primary source anymore. But I use them and use their ideas to construct a more robust portfolio for probably 4 or 5 years, really, which was great, really, alongside having my own high-yield portfolio.
Yeah.
And that was all obviously going very well up until 2007, 2008.
Yes, of course.
You know? Yeah. And then the problem is you get overconfident because things are obviously going well.
Very well, yeah.
Yeah, and you think, okay, I think I know how to do this. You know, I think I understand companies and research, and then it turns out you don't. I had some kind of models on how to choose companies, but then I thought, I could be cleverer than that. So, okay, the rules say that, this company doesn't quite match the criteria, but you know what, actually, I think, it's obviously a good company, so I'm going to buy it anyway. Mm. And I also found out that breaking the rules wasn't always a sensible strategy.
Absolutely. I was going to say to you that in the midst of all of that, that one of the difficulties for all investors is that whenever we get onto a good run, we can become overconfident, but the market always comes back and teaches another lesson. Yeah. And every day is a school day, but everybody learns. So whether it's a fund manager, i.e. currently the last 2 years, Neil Woodford, for instance, has had lots of examples of where he's got it wrong.
Yeah.
And you've not got to beat yourself up and just carry on learning and just be patient with yourself for the next leg, the next journey. And the best investors are found out in bear markets.
Yes.
So if you're a good investor, you'll do well and come out of it even stronger. So.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Yeah. I think complacency is a very dangerous thing. And it's easy to fall into that trap. I mean, I think the one thing that saved me through all these years is not having a too concentrated portfolio. Because if I'd had a concentrated portfolio with my bad ideas, then it would have been a disaster. But fortunately, I had 40 or 50 shares in there.
Yeah.
And so even though several of them, went close to zero, that wasn't it wasn't fatal.
Good.
That reflects on my own kind of risk averseness, really.
Diversifying to the numbers.
So
thinking about diversification now, how many, on average, companies do you hold throughout, say, an annual year? Do you keep a steady sort of number, or do you looking for opportunities and you think, I'm going to have all them?
My turnover is quite low, actually. Mm. I mean, companies come in, they come out, but I mean, I'm probably only doing, certainly less than 10 trades a month, probably sometimes less than five. I mean, there's not a lot of changing going on. And the portfolio size is usually somewhere between 35 and 45 companies.
Average throughout the year,
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I'd quite like to bring it down a little bit. Mm-hmm. I think, 45 is probably too many, and 30 to 35 would be a better number. But on the other hand, when you've got companies in there that you think are, are good companies, but the market hasn't quite caught up with them, or the situations for them hasn't quite worked out, so in it takes time for their story to come out, then I figure, well, I don't want to just sell the thing just because I'm bored. Mm-hmm. I need to know whether or not this is going to work. There are companies in there that will stay in there for a while I, like Next, let's say. Mm-hmm. I bought Next probably 3 or 4 years ago. And it's a great company, fantastically well-run, great returns on capital. Mm-hmm. And I love the quality of their reporting and the management. And so I bought into that. Now, obviously, times have been tough for them. But I think actually they are going to recover in the long term, and I don't see a real reason to sell them just because they've gone down. Mm-hmm. But it's going to take time.
Yeah, I mean the UK's largest online retailer.
Yeah,
and essentially they're going to go less towards footfall in their bricks and mortar and more towards their online. So
exactly, that is their saving grace.
That's
really
the saving grace. Yeah. So and they've got Lord Wolfson there, who's been a phenomenal success there. So
yeah, stunning.
It's got opportunities there. And then you've got the PE comparing to the likes of Boohoo and all the rest. You're thinking, if Next was on that PE, crikey, what sort of price would it be? But, people like to go for the in-trendy stock sometimes.
They do.
All right, I was going to ask you, what has been your wisest investment decision to date, Damien?
Well, there's a company. I mean, I like many people over the years, I've been burned by oil stocks and other resource stocks and this kind of stuff because, as many people probably experienced, you a story comes out and somebody's talked about the story and they say, oh, this looks fantastic. They've got this fantastic deposit somewhere in Africa and all they need to do is this and, the price of nickel is doing that. I mean, it's going to go up by 100 times.
Yeah.
So I've had a few of those. But there's an oil company that I invested in 10 years ago called Dragon Oil. And that actually came out of Fat Profits. So that that was one of their research items. And that had wells in Turkmenistan. So totally, off the radar, really. But they were doing very well. It was a well-run company. They were steadily increasing production. They weren't kind of drilling all over the world. They had a good resource. But they were majority owned by ENOC, which is a national oil corporation. And while I was holding them, ENOC decided they'd like to take the whole company private. And they put in an offer. Let's say the share price was £4. They put in an offer of like £5.50 or something like that. And the message boards kind of were up in arms because it was worth more. And that was a good company. But luckily, a group of shareholders got together, minority shareholders in the company, and they said, well, we can probably stop this if we band together, because the majority shareholder at ENOC couldn't vote on whether or not the takeover could happen. That's the thing. They were because they were the takeover party, they could not put their shares forward to vote for it. So it was only the other shareholders that could vote yes or no.
Interesting.
Yeah, so a bit of a movement kind of took place where the minority shareholders said, well, vote against it. And it gathered enough momentum that it was voted down.
Brilliant.
And, obviously you think, well, should we have done that? Because, there was an offer on the table and, what's ENOC going to do? They're going to just throw its toys out the pram. But it didn't. They didn't really do anything. They just kind of held their place and kind of backed off. And then we thought, well, okay, maybe they'll come back. And it turned out that they did come back, but it was like 5 years later. But that was fine because... In the meantime, the price had dropped down because of the financial crisis and this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, I reckon ENOC is going to come back at some point. They still majority own a share of this company. Mm. And so I sold, five other shares I had and put all of that money into Dragon Oil. So for me, it was a position that was kind of 10 times the size of any other position I had.
Wow. Okay.
But I thought, actually...
You've done your deep research and you're happy with scaling down.
Yeah, exactly. I was happy to take that position because my feeling was that, ENOC, they haven't sold their shares. They're not getting rid of it. They want this, but they're going to have to kind of pay a decent price for it. And so 5 years later, they came back and they said, well, okay, we want to take it private. We're going to offer you guys £7.50. And then there was some discussion went on and I was like, no, we're probably going to vote that down. And then so they said, okay, fine, we're going to pay you £8. Is that enough?
Go away.
Yeah, exactly. Will you just stop doing this? And that was enough for everyone to say, okay, fine.
Excellent.
Take the company off our hands. That was a good decision.
Absolutely. But that's, again, down to your research and looking for the thread there to think, you know what? I actually believe this is going to happen, and then doing the research to validate it and then making the purchase accordingly. Whereas other people think, you know what? It's been a long time since they've come back. I'm going to sell, and it's selling at 2, 3, lower and lower.
Yes.
And it's like, oh dear, I should have remained invested in that, and it's gone.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, actually, what was also nice was they were paying out a pretty hefty dividend. So you didn't, you were kind of being paid to wait. So it wasn't unpleasant.
No, it was good. Did you compound those dividends?
I probably put into other really terrible shares.
Okay. No. Not to worry. Right. Now, given you've done Motley Fool and Stockopedia and SharePad and all the rest of it, if there was something, Damien, that you could change within the finances industry in relation to investing, what would that be? What is the stuff that's a bit of a bugbear for you currently?
Well, it's interesting to say that because, I think that something that I'm not heavily involved in, but I'm a member and I'm a part of ShareSoc, and they're kind of like, obviously they are trying to change the world for private investors or private investors in the UK, because I think it's an unfair market that we live in, because historically private investors were key investors in companies. It wasn't institutions that held all the power. It was the private investors, and companies wanted to raise money were talked by investors, and you would hold shares directly. You'd be on the register, your name was there. You were a part owner of that company.
Yes.
Whereas Over the last, 20 or 30 years, individual shareholders have been steadily disenfranchised by kind of government actions, really. You know, we hold our shares in nominee accounts. You know, it's very hard to vote. You don't get any reports. You're not even seen somehow as being a part owner. Mm-hmm. And I think perhaps among the wider population, people don't really see shares as being part owners of companies. They see it as a kind of form of gambling. And I think that's a great loss, really, because, you know, we are part owners and, you know, it enables to be part of the economy. And I think it's an important thing for people to be part of the economy and to play a role in financing companies and growth and new companies. I think, you know, there's a good social need for that. Mm. So I think that that's really the biggest problem I see at the moment is that lots of people just give their money to managers and forget about it, and they don't invest because they're kind of, it's a bit of an unknown, and it's seen that it's something that only specialists do, or you know, people who have some other kind of special skills do, which I think that's not true. I think anyone can invest if you follow the central rules. But I think we know our names should be back on the registers, and we should have a much more direct connection with companies. Mm-hmm. And there should be, you know, probably a better information flow between those companies.
Okay. Excellent reply. One last question for you, and I know you like your research and everything else. you mentioned already a book and some books. Is there a particular book that you'd like to share with the listeners that you'd recommend for the, how should I put this, the beginner who needs to just not race into the market, you know, not make the mistakes that you and I have made?
Yeah, I'm not sure any book can stop you making mistakes, to be honest. The only thing I found that stops you making mistakes is making the mistakes and feeling
very
the pain.
Very good, love that.
Yeah. You know, without losing the money, you still think you're a genius, so you've got to lose some money, unfortunately.
Good.
But the important thing is not to lose all of your money.
Yes, no, absolutely.
So, yeah, it's interesting about books. I mean, I've read a number of different books. I mean, I was reading The Zulu Principle recently, which was kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that was written back in kind of the 70s and 80s, so a different investing arena. Mm-hmm. But actually, the lessons hold true now, the ways in which you kind of look at shares and value them and some simple rules for investing are just as true now as they were back then. Mm. Maybe shares aren't quite as cheap as they were, and perhaps, you know, using book value doesn't work as so well now. But actually, that is a good fundamental investing book. But I'm much more attracted to books that talk about companies, how they cook the books and why they collapse and that kind of stuff. Because I actually quite like learning about the downside and what can go wrong, you know, and how you can recognize that. Because I think there's too many books out there that say do this and do that, and, you know, you can be a good investor, or look at these 10 great companies, this is how they succeeded. You know, they're all blowing their own trumpet about how great things can be, and actually I think you're better off learning about how bad things can be and how the wool can be pulled over your eyes and, you know, how they can go wrong.
Absolutely.
And a great book for that is Accounting for Growth by Terry Smith.
Right, okay.
That was written 15, 20 years ago. Mm. So some of the examples aren't relevant, but the underlying logic about this is how companies fool you and, you know, and how they come very close to committing fraud, and those are lessons you should learn, actually, because it's too easy to believe what you read. Mm. Not just in books, but in reports and what people say to you. Not necessarily because they're trying to trick you all the time or necessarily trying to lie, but they may well believe it. Yeah. But it still may not be absolutely true. And you may be getting an answer which is technically true, but if you read between the lines, it's not true. Mm. So you need to be able to get into that psychology, I think.
I think that's a very good point. And the great example currently, or as the demise has happened, is conveniality.
Yes.
In the sense of when they floated in the IPO, they were meant to be going down this strategic route. They never, ever did that.
Yes.
And then moved along and then became acquisitive because all their options were steadily impacted by greater and greater revenue and not actually greater profits.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's an interesting point, actually. Do companies do what they say they're going to do? I mean, I'm a firm believer in management. I mean, if I hear them and they say this and then they do that, then that's great. Yeah. They've done what they said they're going to do. If they don't do it, then I need to know why. And that's quite interesting, because lots of times, say, companies don't quite do what they say they're going to do, or the goalposts change, or what they conveniently forget what they said they were going to do, and they say something else. And you're kind of like, well, wait a second. You know, because people have a short-term memory and the market has short-term memory, people kind of forget it sometimes. But it's good to go back and say, you know what, a year ago, you said this, and why didn't it happen?
Hold them to account. We've got to. It's, you know, you've put your hard-earned money in that company, so you've got a right to speak up.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly what ShareSoc are trying to do on behalf of everybody else. But we also can do that by attending the AGMs and looking that CEO and CFO in the eye.
Yeah, and having some decent questions, really. Put them on the spot.
Yeah, absolutely. I've covered all my questions, Damien.
Okay.
All right. Thank you ever so much for that.
Well, thank you.
An absolute pleasure, mate.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you very much.
Cheers.
Okay.